we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, December the 9th, 2016. I am your host and I am joined here by our guest co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
Hi, Sinead. Welcome to the show. Jen is here in spirit today. She's at home sick. Tomorrow, December 10th, is International Human Rights Day. In light of the recent deaths of two beluga whales, Aurora and Kila, at the Vancouver Aquarium, we'll be having Annalise Sorg on the show today to give us an update on these incidents, including interactions between Van Aqua and animal rights activists, plus the messages that we are seeing in the mainstream media these days with regards to the aquarium. Annalise is with the local nonprofit group No Whales in Captivity, and she also will be telling us about her petition to ask the Vancouver Park Board at this critical time to stop the importation of further whales and dolphins into captivity. Then for our feature interview, we'll welcome back activist and author Robin Lamont to the show. She is an animal suspense novelist, and there are very few people that do what she does, which is to write riveting fiction novels that shine a light on and depict the fight against institutionalized animal cruelty. In her trilogy, The Kinship Series, she writes about the experiences of an animal welfare investigator inspired by true stories. These books also draw parallels between human rights issues and animal rights, and she'll be speaking about those commonalities today in recognition of International Human Rights Day tomorrow. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. So as I mentioned, tomorrow, December the 10th, is International Human Rights Day. It commemorates the day in 1948 when the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So we're a show about animal rights. What does that have to do with human rights, right, Sinead?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Now, I'm wondering, can you tell me, I'm going to move the mic here so I can see you. There, we have eye contact. So can you tell me, how many times before have you heard people say something like, there are too many human problems in the world that we have to solve first before we can think about solving all the animal welfare issues, right?
All the time.
Yes.
All the
or time. Perhaps they've asked you before, why do you care about animals so much instead of humans? Or shouldn't you be caring about humans first? And how does that make you feel when you hear those questions directed at you?
Well, it's frustrating, but yeah, it's mind-boggling because it seems that a lot of people seem to forget that humans are animals, and you say that to people and they go, "Oh, right. Well, we're different than beasts, you know." But we're not. We're primates. We're members of the great ape family. We evolved just like everybody else.
And you know, that statement too that people make, you know, human rights are more important than animal rights, or we have to take care of the human issues first. That really is frustrating to me because I feel like, as you said, we're all animals. Other animals are non-human animals. And it doesn't matter to me, but when I look into a non-human animal's eye, I see a being there, an individual who wants to live just like I do, right? And isn't that kind of like what we can draw it all down to, is that we are all individuals who want to live, who take joy in things that all animals do, such as playing and, you know, sleeping and
having freedom
and loving others and having close relationships with others, be it our own species or not, right? And you often see like animals that are friends with different species that are not humans,
yeah.
right? I kind of see it like we're all the same. And to say that animal rights and human rights are different, what that boils down to is speciesism. Maybe you can explain what speciesism is for those who haven't heard it.
Yeah, well, speciesism is basically, you know, discrimination against certain types of species based on their species, even if they have the same capacity to suffer, essentially, as everybody else. So just, you know, just as people discriminate against fellow humans because of skin color or gender or whatnot, you know, other species, they can feel just like we can. They can experience things in the world just like we can, but we discriminate against them all the time.
Unless they are a companion of ours, i.e. dogs or cats or mm-hmm. rats or birds, but all other species happen to somewhat not be like those. The ones that we see or hear of being in masses, like at factory farms, they're actually unseen. Those big factory farm enclosures, buildings don't have windows on them, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be upwards of 30,000 chickens in one of those, or thousands of thousands of pigs,
mm-hmm.
or other animals, turkeys.
Yeah,
example.
And you think, you know, the word humane gets thrown around a lot. Like, well, you know, we can treat other animals like that. We can treat animals. People separate animals from humans. You know, we can treat them like that because they're different. But the thing is, they aren't different in the ways that matter. Human rights and animal rights are both essentially, you know, they involve empathy for those capable of suffering. And
right.
and so that's why they're connected. And so when you say humane, you have to just ask yourself every time, would you want it to be done to you? Exactly.
If yes, then maybe it's humane, unless mm-hmm. you like torture. So, you know, we're all animals. Everything that happens here on this earth to one another affects one another. And as humans, we cannot act independently under the badge of human rights without it affecting all those around us, and vice versa. I have a favorite book that I would like to recommend if you want to learn more about these topics, as well as we've covered a lot of them on Animal Voices shows in the past. But I highly recommend reading Dr. Will Tuttle's The World Peace Diet. It's one of my top three books that I've ever read. Have you read it, Sinead?
No, I haven't read that one
yet. Okay, so maybe I'll lend you my copy. I only have one copy of this one. It's not that easy to find, but you can definitely order it online. The World Peace Diet, Dr. Will Tuttle, he's a wonderful animal rights activist and philosopher. We've had him on the show a couple times before. And I also want to say, check out some of our shows on Animal Voices at animalvoices.org that discusses different issues of human rights and animal rights and how they do interconnect, such as the rights between LGBTQ people and animal rights. We had a show like that featured on earlier this summer.
Mm-hmm.
When others are oppressed, no one can be free. And that's sort of feminism. And we did a show a few years ago to honor the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, discussing the correlations between domestic violence and animal abuse. There's lots of other commonalities as well, food security and humans. I just want to close with this one quote. As long as people will shed the blood of innocent creatures, there can be no peace, no liberty, no harmony between people. Slaughter and justice cannot dwell together. That was said by Nobel laureate Isaac Bashevis Singer. So on to another note, and we're going to be talking about this later on the show today. Sinead, you and I and Jen, we are all at the protest last week at Vancouver Aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
How was that for you?
It was good. It always feels good to get together with people and speak out about this because, frankly, not enough. You know, there has been a lot of news coverage these days, but there need to be more people standing up for these animals that are held captive at the aquarium. And going there to protest is always an interesting experience for me because I used to volunteer there 12 years ago when I was in high
school. So you were on
the
other side of the mm-hmm. fence, so to speak, the line that we couldn't cross.
Yeah. And I never, during my time volunteering there, I never encountered protesters, but I did see the stuff in the news. And I had questions about it. I was one of the people who said, you know, well, I see what you're saying, but people care about the animals here, you know. But I realized that there's no justification for keeping the animals there and breeding more into captivity.
It's so important to really think about it more deeply, as we do here on the show. We've covered Vancouver Aquarium and captivity many times, and we'll be doing it again today.
Mm-hmm. So at the protest, it was great because, you know, I get to go and I think about that. I think about where I used to be and what I used to believe, and now I get to stand on the side with people who I listened to ultimately over the years, and it was good. And another great thing about Sunday, and something I've noticed at the last few protests that I have attended at the aquarium, is that there were very few people walking in those doors. Like, there are a lot fewer people. I don't know if that's just a fluke the days that I've gone, but
I don't know. I saw a bunch walking. I was there first. I saw a bunch walking when I got there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. No, I mean, there were a couple of big groups of kids and stuff, but as far as, you know, regular traffic coming in, you know, it was pretty slow. So that's always nice. But yeah, you get people listening, you get the odd person shouting, "Yay, Vancouver Aquarium." But ultimately, you know, I think
nothing
that people are doing good work.
Okay, well, thanks for that little update there.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
All right, so we've got a few events coming up, a couple on Vancouver Island, actually. This Saturday from 12 to 2 p.m., the Vancouver Island Vegan Association is organizing a vegan outreach event to get all those holiday shoppers in the vegan spirit. They'll provide pictures of animals for everyone to hold and material for you to distribute, and they'll stand outside the Bay Center entrance holding the images and encourage people to come talk to them, learn more about veganism. So come join them. More details are on their Facebook page, the Vancouver Island Vegan Association. Also, each year the Vancouver Island Vegan Association hosts a holiday-themed community vegan potluck where everyone is invited to come and celebrate great vegan food, love for animals, and the company of friends. Costs will be by donation, and all proceeds are going to Rasta Rescue Sanctuary. And that takes place tomorrow night, 6:30 to 9:30, at Cook Street Village Activity Center. And lastly, in Vancouver this week, there is a meatless meetup this Wednesday, December 14th, at the General Public, which is at 17th and Main. They've got a bunch of vegan sushi options, vegan other options, lots of great food, and all of the vegan options will be 30% off for registered diners. So you can order whatever you want, and all the vegan stuff is 30% off. You can get more info on that, see the menu, and register at meetup.com/meatlessmeetups. If you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Our first interview today is with Annalise Sorg from the Vancouver-based grassroots organization No Whales in Captivity, whose mandate it is to keep informing the government and the public of the inherent cruelty in keeping animals in captivity. Their goal is to stop the Vancouver Aquarium from importing more whales and dolphins for public display. And in light of the recent deaths of two beluga whales at the Vancouver Aquarium in the past weeks, now is the time to step up the message. Hello, Annalise, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Oh, hi.
So there's been a lot happening at the Vancouver Aquarium in the past few weeks with the deaths of two belugas, Kila, and then her mother, Aurora. Can you tell us a bit about the history of these captive cetaceans and what their lives were like at the aquarium, please?
Well, as you can imagine, I mean, the life of whales and dolphins in a concrete tank swimming in their own cesspool, really, is nothing but miserable. Basically, they have to, you know, perform the shows, otherwise they don't get fed, and there's the water pumps running all the time, 24/7. They've got parties, and then the belugas are used in all sorts of entertainment. For instance, they have breakfast with the belugas and beluga petting pools and, you know, the beluga shows, of course, and all sorts of horrible things, really. There's bands playing at night. So that's really what their life has been like, you know, in a nutshell. Poor Aurora, the mother, she was captured in 1990 in Churchill, Manitoba, in the Hudson Bay with four others. She was the youngest and the smallest, so we always noticed that in the tank she got bullied, and it was very sad to see. She found a spot where she would try to hide, and all the way till the end, she was basically one of those whales that are stuck to one spot. It's a classic stereotypical behavior showing that, you know, there's something really wrong. Of course, the aquarium says that they're very happy, but this is interesting too, Allison, because the aquarium will say their whales are happy, but when you say, right, well, they might be sad, they go, oh, no, they don't feel like humans.
Yes, so they're using, that's reverse anthropomorphism, right?
Absolutely. So poor Aurora, she had three babies, and of course the three have died. Kila was the only one who survived past infancy, and she actually got pregnant as well, and about 9 years old, which is very young. I mean, that wouldn't happen in the wild. And her baby died as well. So Aurora and Kila have seen a lot of deaths. They've seen a few belugas die in their tank as well, and a few of them being taken away to SeaWorld, and they don't know what happened to them, obviously. So it's a very sad thing, and I think that anybody who doesn't have any kind of connection, you know, certainly financial connection to the Vancouver Aquarium, must realize that it is cruel to keep whales in captivity. There's just no other way to put it, really.
Hi, Annalise. It's Sinead here. So I was wondering, what do we know about how Kila and Aurora died? Do we know the results of the necropsies?
Actually, that's a really good question, because they've sent samples, I gather, of the tissues of both whales all around the world. I mean, to labs everywhere in the world, and they have pinned it down to either being a toxin or a virus. Now, they haven't come up with the latest, but, of course, the virus could be anything transmitted to them from, well, I think, of course, with all the petting that goes on. The belugas are part of this beluga encounter program, of course, or were, thank goodness it's over. And so the humans will come in, and for their Facebook page picture, they'll pay $150 and stand there for 15 minutes giving them dead fish and patting them on the head and kissing the belugas and the belugas kissing them. So, of course, there's a possibility for transmission there. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of humans touched these whales, you know, in the last month. And so I can't help but think that maybe one of the humans was, you know, diseased in some sort and had some sort of virus that got transmitted to the whales. I don't know. Nobody seems to know. The other possibility is toxins. Now, there's of course the possibility that there's the toxin was created in the tank somehow, or that it was given to the whales, and that's where we come in, because Vancouver Aquarium supporters are basically accusing us And, you know, animal advocates should all be outraged about this, but we're being accused of poisoning the whales.
What do you think about accusations like that? You want to protect the whales and dolphins, and you've been receiving these phone calls and emails accusing you of killing the whales.
Yeah, belugacide is what Dr. Jeff Matthews is calling it, which is just, we think it's a red herring as everything else. They're just trying to, you know, take away attention from their own situation and trying to make us be the guilty parties. Well, you know, the Vancouver police has been involved and say that, and they say that the police says that there's absolutely no evidence to support such a accusation, really. But because of all the things the Vancouver Aquarium has said in the media, yes, we're getting the phone calls and we're getting the emails telling us that we're horrible people and that, you know, we wanted those whales dead and that we poisoned them, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, how do you respond to something like that? I mean, the only thing that we say is let's hope that the results of the necropsies come back soon so these accusations will end once we know what happened. But, you know, the Vancouver Aquarium CEO saying, we won't leave a stone unturned and we're looking through the video minute by minute. Or, you know, okay, that's great, but don't make it sound like, you know, we did it. I mean, I doubt that. I mean, all of us are such a real animal lovers. We love animals alive and we respect them. And, you know, I think that these poor whales at the Vancouver Aquarium have received enough toxins as is with all the Valium and antidepressants and such that they're fed daily in order to keep them in captivity. So it's one of those things that I think we're being used as scapegoats, frankly.
Yeah, those accusations are actually quite ridiculous. Sinead has another question for you here.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about how the aquarium describes themselves as a nonprofit relying on public support to continue their work to protect marine life. So can you tell us more about the meaning of the term nonprofit and where the aquarium gets its funding from, how much of that funding goes to rescue and rehabilitation?
Oh, like less than 1% goes to rescue and rehabilitation. I mean, the thing about the aquarium is this. There's many, many, many layers. So, yes, there is a nonprofit. There is also a charitable society. There is also a foundation, not just in Canada, but in the States as well, so that they can receive large amounts of money in the States and give tax credits there. So, you know, the aquarium is an international entity. That's just the nonprofits and charitable societies that they run, which, of course, bear all the expenses, because that's where the money really goes and the profit really goes is to their companies. They have many, many companies. They've been changing the names, but it used to be really obvious. It was like Vancouver Aquarium Limited, Vancouver Aquarium Consulting Limited, Vancouver Aquarium Management Limited, Vancouver Aquarium Research Limited, and so on and so forth. Lots of corporations that manage the large amount of money that comes into the aquarium through all sorts of avenues, because, of course, we know there's the gate revenues, and then there's the gift store revenues, which is huge because I don't encourage anybody to go to the aquarium. I go because I have to keep an eye on them. But I tell you, they've built gift shops at every corner of the aquarium. It's like you can't turn the corner without another gift shop selling you tacky things that you really don't need. But anyways, so they have money coming in through that. They have money coming in through catering and all sorts of rentals that they do. Of course, they do weddings and birthday parties, and for businesses, they do the breakfast with the whales and et cetera, et cetera. They also have a monopoly on selling seawater treated seawater, so they sell to all the restaurants and the aquariums that have live ocean animals. They have to go to the aquarium, and I can't remember how much it is, but 20 cents a gallon or something, and so the aquarium makes money off that. All of those for-profit businesses are protected by corporation laws that don't allow us to see what really is going on in there. But we know that the same executive committee of the Vancouver Aquarium charitable foundations are the same people that run these corporations. So, you know, there's always something fishy going on at the aquarium, and this is, the money is obviously the biggest reason that whales are there, and that's really what we're dealing with here.
Well, that was a lot of information. Thanks for sharing that. As we all know, mainstream media tends to cut out a lot of the interviews that they do with animal activists short, so you're only getting certain sound clips from people who are on the side of the whales and dolphins. This editing compromises the truth. So maybe could you comment on this, and what do you want the public to know about the aquarium that the media, the mainstream media, isn't talking about?
Yeah, the mainstream media actually has surprised us this time because, you know, for those of you who are old and like me, you will remember that the whales used to be in the news every day. I mean, every day, really. Oh. It was unbelievable how much news there was. And then the aquarium managed to, we think what probably happened was they said, well, if you keep having the activists on the media, we're not going to, you know, give you advertising dollars. And that's how I figure they control the media, because it's unbelievable. In the last few years, we'll get calls from a reporter, and I'll always say to them, you know, mainstream media, obviously, you know, whether it's TV or radio or newsprint, I'll always say to them, are you sure the editor is going to let you put this, you know, publish this or put it on the air? And I'm doing my job, and you know, don't worry about it, right? Well, lo and behold, the whole news story would be canceled last minute, or I would get a call to be on CKNW with Simi Sarah or somebody like that because something's going on, and I'll be talking to the producer, blah 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 blah, and then Simi will call me and say, oh no, I can't have you on my show today. So it's, you know, what's going on there when it used to be, and obviously it's such a popular controversial issue that the media wants to have us on, but the aquarium's been adamant about not, you know, being partaking in conversations like that. So now this time with the two beluga deaths, they couldn't control it. It was just too big. And you could see, you know, the CEO and other aquarium reps just becoming so upset and saying, why is, you know, in the media, becoming upset with the media, telling, you know, people to not, why are they interviewing us and not to contact us, right? And, of course, the media has an obligation, really, to put both sides out, but it is compromised. So, like you say, it is compromised to a certain point, although, as I said, we are surprised with this last episode here how much the media has been able to actually put out there. So we're really happy with that.
That's good. I don't think it's enough, though, and that's why we had you on the show today. So we just have just under a minute left. Please tell us about the petition you have circulating for the Vancouver Park Board, and what do you see as the next steps in succeeding in your campaign?
Yes, the petition is for no new whales, no new dolphins, and that's always what we've had. The petition, I know it's on Animal Voices website there, so please, your listeners, if they could go and help us out. We need as many signatures. Every time you sign, a message goes to all the Park Board commissioners and all the city councilors telling them that it's time to ban the importation of whales and dolphins and start a phase out. Now that we don't have orcas, now that we don't have belugas at the Vancouver Aquarium, it's time to shut those exhibits down, and that's it. So we need to continue to push pressure on the Vancouver Park Board. that's really the next step.
Yes, now is the time. Thank you, Annalise, for joining us on the show today to tell us about the recent issues happening with the Vancouver Aquarium and your observations on reactions between the media and the public to find this petition to ask the Vancouver Park Board to stop the importation of cetaceans into the aquarium. You can find it on our website, animalvoices.org. You can also find it posted today on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And just a reminder, if you want to find out more about the issues about what's happening at the aquarium, watch the film called Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered on YouTube. It's free. Thank you so much for being with us today, Annalise. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you for the opportunity and keep at it. You guys are doing great.
Thanks. And now we have some news with Sinead.
Yeah, so speaking of films, last weekend a new documentary called Sled Dogs premiered at the Whistler Film Festival, in spite of some people in the sled dog industry asking to have it pulled. So the film takes a critical look at the sled dog industry and aiming to shed light on the lives of the dogs both during racing season and throughout the rest of the year. And when the director set out to make the film, she wasn't sure what she'd find. She wanted to explore the issue. And unfortunately, she found some pretty shocking stuff. So dog sledders from all over are speaking out, saying how much they care for their dogs and how this film paints them all as unfairly as cruel. And the director says she just documented, as I say, what she saw. So the film festival said that the industry people making complaints must have been going by the trailers that they saw, because the film wasn't actually available for viewing until it premiered on Saturday. So they say that the film was well-researched and provided a balanced view, and that everyone might feel better after actually watching it. So the film screened on December 3rd as planned and wound up winning 2 awards. It tied for the World Documentary Award with a film called The Will to Fly, and it also won Best Female Directed Documentary. So that's pretty cool and pretty interesting, and we will actually have the director, Fern Levitt, on the show next week for an interview to talk about the film and the controversy surrounding it. So definitely.
I'm really looking forward to that interview. I watched the film yesterday. It's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well. Also, earlier this week, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency released some long-awaited proposed amendments to the rules that govern the treatment of farmed animals during transportation, called the Health of Animals Regulations. So the current regulations are decades old and considered by experts to be the worst in the Western world. Up to 8 million animals per year arrive at the slaughterhouse already dead or too sick or injured to be considered fit for human consumption. In 2014, Animal Justice led a coalition of animal protection organizations in providing recommendations to the federal government about updating the transport regulations, saying to do it quickly, and those recommendations have been largely ignored. The length of time the new regulations allow animals to be transported without access to food, water, or rest continues to exceed most of the developed world. Pigs and horses will be transported for up to 28 hours, cows up to 36 hours, chickens up to 24 hours, including egg-laying hens who are very fragile and die at high rates during transportation. The proposed regulations fail to protect animals from extreme weather as well when they're transported through Canada in these open-sided trucks through icy cold winters or boiling hot summers. Actually, in the European Union, vehicles are required to be kept between 5 and 30 degrees Celsius for the animals. But
not the case here, right?
No.
I actually just saw a picture at Toronto Pig Save yesterday in Burlington. Pigs arriving to the slaughterhouse and they're freezing.
Yeah. So it's really horrific. They arrive at the slaughterhouse frozen to the sides of the trucks sometimes, and it's awful. So the new rules just reword the existing rules, and transporters are not required. They're still not required to have any insulation or ventilation to monitor temperature. And they don't prohibit the use of electric prods, too, which was another complaint, not even on animals who are too weak to stand. So animal justice has expressed disappointment, and they're saying the government is prioritizing the convenience and profits of animal use industries at the expense of animal welfare, which it appears that they are. But it's not too late for the government to get its act together. There is a 75-day comment period before these bleak regulations become law. And so let's keep the pressure up until February. You can visit animaljustice.ca to send a letter to the government and let them know that these new regulations are not acceptable to Canadians.
Well, thank you for the news, Sinead.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Our feature interview today is with author Robin Lamont. Based in New York State, Robin's diverse career history has seen her working as a singer, a Broadway and film actress, a private investigator, an assistant district attorney, and now an award-winning novelist. Her first novel, If Thy Right Hand, was named Best of 2011 by Suspense Magazine and won the gold medal from the 2012 Independent Publisher Book Awards. Her latest work has been on a set of novels called The Kinship Series, which follows an animal rights investigator's various missions and experiences in exposing animal abuse. Starting at a small town pig slaughterhouse with the release of The Chain in 2013 and delving into the world of animal trapping with her latest book, The Trap, Robin is set to publish The Kinship Series' third installment entitled The Experiment in the new year. We'll be asking her about that and more on today's show. Hello, Robin, and welcome back to Animal Voices.
Well, hello. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, your career path, as I mentioned, has been incredibly diverse, to put it mildly. So it'd be great if we could start by just hearing more about your history. How did you go from singer and actress to undercover investigator to county prosecutor to novelist?
Yeah, it has been quite a journey. Well, I began my career as a Broadway actress, doing a lot of the rock musicals and various things in New York City. And at some point, I needed a day job, so a friend of mine introduced me to a private investigator who hired actors to do undercover work. He thought they made the best undercover agents. And I signed on. So I did that for a number of years. But as you can imagine, working undercover has a relatively short lifespan. Once your face gets known in whatever fields you're traveling in, you're pretty much burned. So I decided to go to law school. After that, I became a county prosecutor. And after doing that for a number of years, I left to write novels, which is something I'd always dreamed of.
Right on. Well, so when did you first get involved with animal advocacy then? What ultimately inspired you to start writing the Kinship series?
I guess about 5 years ago, maybe six, my husband and I began looking into the horrors of factory farming. I read Gail Eisnitz's book, Slaughterhouse, and for me, that was a transformative experience. So as I began to understand what was happening to animals, I was already writing suspense novels, and I decided I wanted to create a protagonist in the thriller suspense genre that would fight for animals. After I wrote The Chain, I decided I wanted to keep Jude Brannock going for more.
And we're certainly grateful that you did. So how do you choose which subjects to write about then? Are the stories in your novels inspired at all by your own personal experiences as an undercover investigator?
Well, not for Jude. I mean, in terms of the subjects, I pretty much go where my interests and passions take me. For The Chain, a slaughterhouse town, and what was happening for the workers and the animals kind of grab me. I love wolves, so learning about what was happening to them and other wildlife out west inspired the trap. When I worked as a private investigator, I worked anti-counterfeiting, which is quite different than working undercover investigations for the animal rights organizations.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand what it's like to be undercover and what it's like to kind of, it's sort of like walking on a tightrope. There's no backup. And you're out there kind of free-floating, and it can be somewhat dangerous, and you have to continually maintain a role. So I try to bring that into the book for Jude, who does a lot of undercover work.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you tell us more about Jude Brannick, the animal rights investigator and lead protagonist in the Kinship series? How did her character come to develop?
Well, you know, it's funny that you asked that, because I'm finding that as I work on this third novel, Jude is continuing to develop. You know, writing a character like that it's kind of like getting to know somebody. The more time you spend with them, the deeper your knowledge of what makes them tick. In the first two books, Jude is pretty headstrong in her desire to prevent animal suffering. But in this third book, I dive into how her single-mindedness costs her in a personal way, not just with relationships, but also psychologically herself. And it creates some new tensions that are not just between her and the exploiters of animals.
I have a question for you, Robin. It's Allison here. So you mentioned being inspired by Gail Eisnutz, who wrote Slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
Earlier in the show, I was talking about my top three books in my whole life. One of them is The World Peace Diet that I mentioned, and one of them is Slaughterhouse by Gail Eisnutz.
Yeah.
So I think you've met her, haven't you? I'm just curious to know like how that whole experience was. I would love to meet her. I loved that book. And I love that you're writing about, because her story of Slaughterhouse was her as an investigator looking into the back scenes of what happens in slaughterhouses. What did you learn from Gail?
Well, you know, when I decided to write The Chain, my husband was the one who said, well, why don't you reach out to Gail Eisnutz and see if she'll talk to you?
Yeah.
I did, and she was most gracious, inviting us both down to North Carolina for a weekend. And we went down and spent a wonderful weekend with her. She's the nicest person you can possibly imagine. And she's also been through a hell of a lot in terms of her own investigations and what it took for her to write Slaughterhouse. So it was wonderful to be able to meet her, and she continues to be an inspiration to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is our annual International Human Rights Day show for tomorrow, December 10th. And the issue of human rights is something that you have definitely touched on in your novels. One example would be in the first book of the Kinship series, The Chain. Jude finds herself in a small town to investigate reports of brutal animal cruelty at a local meatpacking plant, a slaughterhouse, which this small town happens to depend on for its survival. So she's seen as the enemy and labeled as a terrorist in the town because the locals don't want to lose their only source of income. However, as we discover, and as Jude discovers, not everyone is actually happy to be working at the plant. So can you tell us more about what you've learned about how human workers are abused and exploited in slaughterhouses and in other animal exploitation industries?
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic because it's not just about the animals. It's about people, too. And in the research that I did for The Chain, I learned about, you know, Linda, conditions in slaughterhouses are incredibly dangerous for the workers. They deal with everyday sharp knives, the blood-soaked floor, and, of course, frightened, struggling animals. But what I also learned was that the psychological damage could be even greater. I mean, this story was told over and over again in Gail's book, where workers talked about having to shut down their emotions in order to kill living beings day after day. And many interviews with meatpacking employees talk about the same thing. Studies have shown that in slaughterhouse communities, the rates of drug and alcohol abuse and domestic violence rise significantly. You know, we don't know for sure what the emotional cost of industrialized animal exploitation is to our society. But if we know that it happens in slaughterhouses, it's unreasonable to think that this cost is not also felt by lab workers who experiment on unwilling animals, or by people who raise animals for fur. It could go on and on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that even if we can't document it, it's something we must look at, that I don't believe that people want animals to suffer. So when we force them into industries and jobs that in which they do this every day, what is the cost to them?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And, yeah, I mean, in your book as well, you know, a lot of the workers at the slaughterhouse, it's said that half of them don't speak English. A lot of them are immigrants, and they aren't working with a lot of money to begin with. And it sounds like the conditions are pretty harsh for them in there. So drawing from your own experiences, as well as those of the activists you've researched for your books, what would you say it's like to be trying to bring down industries or businesses, either through investigation or writing or anything, that the desperate people currently depend on for survival? Are there ways that we can protect and speak out for animals and also help humans who are involved in these industries?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think both of those go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to bring down industries that are making big profits in animal exploitation, and not even to mention the cultural acceptance we have of using animals for what we perceive are our needs. It really is a David and Goliath scenario. I think that the key to helping workers who depend on these industries for their income and their survival is to establish animal protections so that we can get them out of these jobs and into others that won't hurt the animals and will, in fact, better the workers' self-esteem. I think it's similar to environmental issues. You can work for the oil industry, or you can work for clean energy. You know, the first is really bad for the earth. The second is helpful, and they're both jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I think these workers, they don't want to be in animal exploitation fields. What they want is a living wage. So I think if we can find ways to protect animals in jobs that give them a living wage, I think that's going to help people.
Absolutely. I think Allison had a question.
Yeah. Hi again, Robin.
Hi.
So we've had you on the show before. I remember you spoke about the deer call and your activism towards that. You spoke about effective letter writing in activism.
Right.
And you're one of the only people I know that does animal activism through fiction writing. So I'm wondering if you can explain for us, what kind of a role do you think fiction writing can play in activism, particularly animal rights activism?
Well, I appreciate the question, because This is a topic near and dear to my heart. I am a big believer in the power of stories. Research has shown that our brains are actually hardwired for story. They were critical to our evolution. They allow us to simulate intense experiences without actually having to live through them. In the Stone Age, this was a matter of life and death. When if you waited for experience to teach you that the rustling in the bushes was actually a lion looking for lunch, you'd end up the main course. And again, I don't think people want animals to suffer, but in their everyday lives, they don't give a lot of thought to the things that they do that contribute to that. And the goal is to reach them in a way that awakens their natural compassion to the degree that they'll make lifestyle changes. I like sometimes to reference a part in Alice Through the Looking Glass, when Alice is with the Mock Turtle and the Griffin. And Alice says, "Oh, I could tell you my adventures beginning from this morning, but it's no use going back to yesterday because I was a different person then." The Mock Turtle asks her to explain all that, at which point the Griffin jumps in and shouts, "No, no, the adventures first. Explanations take such a dreadful time." So, for me, my animal advocacy starts with the adventures.
That's great. I think that's a great way to put it. And also, I also feel I'm always talking about the, I guess, just the power of storytelling here on Animal Voices, right, Sinead? I'm always
yes.
saying we should tell stories. And you just said that. You just validated my claim, because I think that storytelling is just so important, and more people should write fiction novels that have to do with animal rights issues, because that's perhaps the only way you're going to get through to some people who love reading fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easier to get people through writing sometimes than it is through photos, you know, of pictures of slaughterhouses. It's so easy to turn it off. But when you're reading a story, such as one of your great stories, Robin, and you get engaged and you care. So that's great.
I believe that. I think that it engages people without their even knowing it. And it engages their emotion rather than just an intellectual ability to understand. And that is the key to actually getting them to change their own behavior and their own way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've mentioned, I've been loving your books, and so I'm excited to know, can you tell us about the next book in the Kinship series?
Yes, sure. I'm working on it now, and it's called The Experiment. I'm pretty excited about it. The book involves a young kinship investigator working undercover in an animal testing laboratory. One day, he goes missing inexplicably. Jude sets out to find him, and in the course of her journey, encounters some pretty dark secrets in what appears to be a wholesome organic farming community. She also confronts some pretty dark secrets that she's been keeping from herself. So I hope, you know, people will take a look when it comes out and let me know what they think.
Well, I'm certainly excited for that.
I am too.
Well, I just want to thank you, Robin, for joining us on the show today to tell us about the Kinship series novels and how writing fiction can equate to animal activism. To find out more about The Chain, The Trap, and The Experiment, you can go to Robin's website, thekinshipseries.com. Thank you, Robin, so much for coming on the show today. And this was a great interview. Your books are great, and I hope you have a great day.
Oh, thanks, Sinead and Allison. It's great to talk to you as always.
Thank you. Have a good day. So you have been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Next week's show is going to be a good one. As for our feature interview, we've already mentioned before, we'll be speaking with film director Fern Levitt about her new documentary film called Sled Dogs. It just won 2 awards at last week's Whistler Film Festival and will be available on the CBC Documentary Channel soon. This film exposes the gruesome realities of the sled dog industry. I watched it yesterday and I learned a lot. And we will also likely be having Issa Chandra Moskowitz on the show. She's a very well-known vegan cookbook author, has just come out with a new book called The Super Fun Times Vegan Holiday Cookbook, which I'm reading right now, and has some great recipes in it, as usual, for Issa. And hopefully we'll have her on the show next week to talk about cooking for the holidays and about some of the food in her book. So we here at Animal Voices, we want to connect with you online. AnimalVoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts. You can read our show blog there with detailed links. And you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. For today's show, I'm going to be playing a song called Be Kind to the Innocent, a song for animal rights. Very, I would say, very ideal for today's show and all of our shows always. And remember, tomorrow is International Human Rights Day. This song is by Simone DeBico. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
please give me the right just to be here.